You are listening to the ArtSpark TX Radio Hour on 91.7 FM, Co-op HD1, HD3, Hornsby, or on the live stream at www.coop.org. Co-op is community-led, solar-powered, volunteer-run radio. On the ArtSpark TX Radio Hour, we provide information and advocacy by and for the disability community. Hosted by Celia Hughes of ArtSpark, Texas, where we spark the creative in everyone. We challenge perceptions of how people contribute by supporting an arts-inspired community of individuals with and without disabilities. The views expressed here are not necessarily the views or opinions of Co-op Radio or of its board of directors, volunteers, staff, or underwriters. Welcome to the ArtSpark TX Radio Hour. Hi there. This is Celia Hughes, and you're listening to the ArtSpark TX Radio Hour. And today's episode is a recording that I made with my dear friend Terry Galloway. Terry Galloway is a deaf performance artist who started here in Austin. She was one of the co-founders of Esther's Follies, and she's worked with ArtSpark as the co-founder and director of Actual Lives Austin, which we will talk a little bit about in this episode. Terry now lives in Tallahassee, Florida, where she stirs up hurricanes everywhere she goes. So I'm delighted to be able to bring to you Terry Galloway. So sit back and be prepared to enjoy an hour-long conversation with my buddy, Terry Galloway.
So can you tell us your name and a little bit about you?
Okay. First of all, my name is Terry Galloway, and it's spelled with a Y, not an I, because I've always thought an eye would make me a poodle. Secondly, I have a touch of laryngitis because I was at No Kings in every protest you can do, screaming my guts out. And also playing with my nieces and screaming my guts out. So I've done myself no favors, nor have I done you, whoever is listening to this, any favors. I'm deaf, and I got a cochlear implant too. After 50-something years of being, okay, look, I'm deaf, but I always considered myself with the disability community more than the deaf community. And because I didn't know that many other deaf kids when I was growing up, they didn't even discover that I was going deaf until we came back from Berlin, where I was born in Stuttgart, Germany. And we came to Texas, and they gave us these little test, the hearing and ear test, and they discovered that I was going deaf, that I had a progressive deafness that was caused by the introduction of drugs to the fetal nervous system. And they didn't know that until they started doing all of these tests. And I went to my parents and I said, Mommy, Daddy, I can fly. I can fly. And it was hallucinatory effects because I wasn't hearing and I wasn't seeing. So, that's how they discovered that it was a progressive deafness. And it was weird because it was so erratic. It happened so gradually that they didn't know it, because I was also a natural lip reader. And that's going to count in a minute, because I want to talk about atrocities done to deaf kids. not necessarily to me. And so they discovered I was deaf, and that it was progressive and there was nothing they could do about it. And then I was cured, I guess, by having hearing aids and glasses. But sometimes the cure is worse than the disease. And I was a rambunctious little tomboy, a queer really. But, you know, I like to wallow in mud and play and do stuff like that. And we put these very expensive, huge hearing aids that fit between my boobs, like a third one. And you can't. You're so constrained. It almost makes you insane. So that's where I come to disability. But the reason I identify so strongly with the disability community rather than the deaf community is that my parents didn't want me to be deaf. So when I was given a choice in Texas of going to the school for the deaf or going to a regular school, I know my parents didn't want me to do that. They didn't want me to sign because, like so many parents of that time, they thought that kind of physicality that's involved with that expression, with sign, with that beautiful physicality, they thought it was animalistic. They didn't want me being an animal. I was an animal enough as it was. Really, I just like to ram around and beat up people.
Right. I know they're a little...
Okay, so anyway, I'm sorry. That's a very rambling way of getting about. So, but that's the essence.
Yeah, I think what I think is interesting is that you said that when they gave you hearing aids, that you were cured. And maybe that was the thought back then, but it's... So, I mean, that was just an accommodation.
An accommodation.
You know, to help you somewhat.
It's just an aid.
Yeah.
The hearing aid.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And if you don't have any hearing, there's not much to aid, you know? And so you think that by the time, how old were you, do you think, by the time you really had lost your hearing? Mm-hmm. Where you didn't have any hearing left. Do you remember how old you were?
Well, the most profound discovery was when I was 9. It got progressively worse. And I think probably up into my late teens, that's when it started. That's when it really, really, I was a lip reader.
Yeah.
And I had, there was sound. It gave me my sound. But man, It made me such a jerk because I would do what I just did, which was monopolize, because I couldn't handle the back and forth of conversation because too often I really didn't know what people were saying to
me.
Right. It was embarrassing.
Yeah.
And so it was about then. So that, and I wore hearing aids up until I was like 55 because they were my security blanket.
Right.
You know, even if it was just buzzing confusion, who cared? It was buzzing confusion. You know, I wanted that.
Right.
Wanted
and what you needed that.
Yeah. Yeah. But man, you hear all these stories about how the, you know, the oral tradition and all of that. It was very cruel.
Yeah.
And they didn't know it. Everybody thought they were helping, but it was so cruel.
Right.
You know, remember Jimmy Turner?
Yes.
Yes. And remember how he didn't even have language because they wouldn't let him use his hands.
Right.
And are just so determined.
Well, and that was so much during the, like, you know, when the states first brought in the schools for the deaf, it was all about, you know, making deaf people fit in to a hearing society. And they would be punished and have their hands tied behind their backs and all kinds of things.
And I met those kids. And I didn't have that happen to me. The reason I love the disability community or became more identified as the Lions Camp for Crippled Children, as it's called. And, you know, so many of my friends in actual life, they remember the Lions Camp for Crippled Children.
Yeah.
Laura, all of these people who remember.
Just about anybody, a Texan with a disability, went to the Lions Camp.
Yes.
Of a certain age. And I think they probably still have it. I don't think they call it.
A handicap anymore. Not until I've got crippled.
I don't think they call it.
Although among us cripples,
they might. Who knows?
With attitude.
So
this feels like such an in conversation.
So talking about that, your childhood and your deafness and your you didn't know you were queer back then. You just thought you were insane.
I thought I was a lustful slut at the age of 9. What is wrong with me?
But so how did that influence who you are today?
Oh, well, you know.
I have stumped Terry Galloway.
No, I'm really trying to be thoughtful, but I find a hard time being thoughtful. I just want to open my mouth and let it just slip out. But of course it did, because I remember when we left Berlin and we were flying from Berlin to New Jersey or wherever it is we did. I remember being a certain kind of kid. And I was very confident. Arrogant, actually. I would have been a really arrogant kid. And there is that arrogance still. And that crumbled. And that became replaced with a kind of a deep insecurity. Because if my body could do this to me and do it to my friends, the people I got to know through the Lions Camp for crippled children, all of those kids, the things that you I had never seen children with bodies like the bodies that I saw at that camp. And at first I thought, these are freaks. What is this? And they became my friends. But I would do the most awful things. It's just like, I get dragging a blind girl because I try to show her, no, you can't go there. I mean, do infantilizing them. It's so awful, patting the smile. It's just, but I didn't know. I wanted them to love me. I wanted, but what I saw was that kind of body. And when you see that, your idea of the world is happily ever after. That's not there anymore. And that's a different definition of happily ever after. And so that affected me. I couldn't, that kind of innocence goes bye-bye really, really quickly when something like this happens to you, because you see the worst and you see the best, and you see people try to be helpful and do terrible things and the guise of being helpful. I know I was remembering, I can't remember who it was. He said they had like 36 operations by the time they were 12, with spinal bifida or something,
Yeah, I think it was Jeff.
Oh yes, Jeff. It was Jeff. And I'm going, and this is a kid. These kids are what parents would do.
Well, in the medical field, because they were being experimented upon
Yes.
in terms of, I mean, we work with people today that have bodies that were created by the medical field. They would have different bodies and maybe more functioning bodies if they hadn't been operated on and
Yes.
tendons cut and all kinds of things like that.
Yes.
And you say, oh, well, they were thinking they were doing the best. I don't know. The older I get, I wonder, were they really thinking they were doing the best, or were they just trying, were they,
Diddling about.
yeah, they had a, somebody they could experiment on,
The expendables. I think there's a lot of that. I think there is do-gooding. We know they're good people and they're out there fighting, and we know that they're monsters. And one of them was a and I'm going her name is a good dear friend of mine. Her brother had cerebral palsy. He was an artist, and he was also he could paint with his feet. He wrote poetry. He was alive. He had like a lot of people with palsy. He couldn't he, his He could be inarticulate, not inarticulate. He was never inarticulate, but he could not always be understood. And so you would lose the beauty of the language. When he turned 18, this surgeon told him, I have just the operation for you, and this will allow you to speak and be normal. And so his parents were going, no, he's in New York or something. There's a New York surgeon. And his parents are going, no, but he's 18. So he says, I'm going to do it. He does it. Drilled a hole in his skull and poured alcohol in it. This is a prominent New York surgeon, and I know because my friend, who was his sister, when she read the obituary of that son of a surgeon, she was so happy, and just all she could think is she hoped he died in pain, because the result of that boy never spoke again.
Well, I was wondering about
Yes,
that.
can you imagine?
Well,
Everybody's like, well, I think this will work. Let's just drill a hole. They used to do it. I mean,
and
God.
pour alcohol in. Oh my
Or,
God.
I mean, I couldn't believe it. When Alice told me this, it was just like, what? What?
So Terry and I met 25 years ago.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, in 2000, we did the first Austin, the actual Lives
Was
Austin.
that really, yeah?
Yeah, it was in 2000.
Huh?
And just a few years ago, we were children. We were mere children. But how did so what is Actual Lives? I mean, is it still around? Or are you've got it's manifested itself in a whole new level at Mickey Faust, which we'll talk about in a little while. But Actual Lives came from a real experience that you had that
Yeah, it
you
did.
really needed to, you as an artist felt that you needed to do something about.
Yeah, I was touring with a thing called PS-122, and it was me, a woman, I think a woman named Laurie Carlos, who used to work with maybe
Urban Bushwoman.
Urban Bushwoman, and Blue Man Group. And we were touring
Wow.
Europe. Yeah, we were touring Europe. And everybody was doing workshops, and Blue Man was doing drumming and painting. And Laurie or whoever, well, I think it was Laurie Carlos, she was doing one of music. And they put me in with all these people with disabilities because they thought, oh, she's going to know everything about it. And I thought, I know nothing. These people with disabilities, I've never, ever heard of. What are you doing? So it was in Manchester. And we were all sitting in this room, and I had these things that I thought I should be doing that I'd never really used myself, that there are all these theater games. But these people couldn't do that. A lot of them didn't have the physical strength to do it, the vocal ability to do it. So everything we tried was a failure. And I was just going, oh my God, I can't do this. And then I just said, look, who are you? Tell me who you are. And those stories were more theatrical than anything you could have imagined or written or this. I mean, you had people who had at this man who had a stroke, but he loved Shakespeare. You think what are the things he could anything because he fought for the language. It was marvelous to behold. There was a woman who had, she had been a dancer. She had been hit by a car. She's in a wheelchair, but her arms. They were gorgeous. It was beautiful. And there were these the twins with Down syndrome, and they were in their 60s, and which was a longevity for Down syndrome then. And they were dressed in their Sunday best. And we were in this community center, and I opened, they were curious about the curtain. We opened it, and there was a cross, and they just went to their knees and started praying. But they could make bird sounds. Beautiful mimicry. And so we started talking about our lives. And I wish I could say I had this epiphany. I kind of did, but it wasn't right there then. But I loved what we did. I loved what I heard. It just resonated. These stories resonated more with me than the made-up stories that people are doing. It's like that sometimes the pretensions of performance art, I laugh at it with my friends with disabilities because we could do some of those things in which they martyr themselves or they hurt themselves or they scream for 15 hours because sometimes people with disabilities scream for 15 hours because they're stuck between their beds and their wheelchairs. They can't get up or their catheters are overrunning. So there's always this thing here. What's devised theater? And constructed theater, there. And so this idea of devised theater, I really loved it. So I couldn't do anything with it at that time. But then I was asked to teach as a guest artist at what is the Performing Arts College in California, California Art. I don't know. It's a art school,
Okay.
very well known. Blah blah blah. So I was asked to do it, and that's when I started that. And
Okay.
but
I
when
did
I
not
came to
know that.
UT,
Okay.
when I came to UT,
So when you were in California,
I was in California. That's
were
when I first
you
started. Oh, I
teaching
was horrible.
were with people with disabilities or
No,
okay.
there was nobody with a disability. It was these
Okay.
art kids. And
Okay.
also I was a terrible teacher. I mean, I had no idea how to grade. I said everybody gets an A. I don't know how to do this. I was horrible. I was really truly awful. But when I came to UT, I thought, I want to do this with people with disabilities. I'm going to do this with people with actual lives. And so I thought, oh, people with disabilities are going to flock. And I had one. And then Chris came, who is an occupational therapist, Chris Fickling. She was an occupational therapist. And there's one kid with a disability. And that kid had then, it was called multiple personality disorder. And if and she did, and that time we didn't have phones. She had a little recordings. And she did recordings of her voice on all of these different devices of her many devices and strapped them to her body and just stood there and turned them on. And I thought it was so, I couldn't hear it, but it was so clever.
Yeah.
So, and I thought, where are they? You know, because the disability ones were just, they're all clever, but that was, so well, it was Chris.
Yeah.
But he got me in touch with you.
Right. Because back then, 25 years ago, people with disabilities were not invited to tell their stories.
Not only that, they also had a real aversion to it because I remember it was Meg or somebody who said, I don't want people looking at me on stage because they're staring and gaping at me. And that's when we're saying, but you get to stare back.
Yeah, exactly. That's the
point. You're staring back. You're controlling.
You're
controlling the gaze, Meg. And that's why Meg came out.
Yeah.
And Terry Dauber was the first person that I met from the actual lives. And she came in and was telling you a story about losing her wheelchair.
Right.
And it went off to Ohio without her. And this was a sad story. And I got so tickled by it. I started laughing.
Right.
And I know she thought I was the rudest little creep in the world, but it was funny. Right. There was something so ridiculous about it.
Something, yeah, exactly.
Yes. And you laugh too.
You have to tell these stories.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, and yeah, and it, the way that story played out through the show that we did was that Terry told the story, but she told it in sections throughout the night. So that whenever she came back out on the stage, she was telling, and then, but because if she had just told the story, it would have been, everybody would have believed.
But you had to theatricalize it.
Exactly.
And that's what we're telling people. I mean, their stories could be so easily theatricalized.
Right.
And then we would also say, well, what are things like, who was the woman with the vision impairment who sang so beautifully?
Diane.
Yes. And I remember that she made her way when we were doing this, and we were doing it at the Vanguard, wasn't it?
Vortex.
Was it?
The Vortex.
Yeah, Vortex. I love Vortex. They're wonderful. And they have the best pasta. It's a wonderful thing. And they did the dog, the mutt Christmas. And I love them. But that was the first place that we did it.
Right.
And it was wonderful because people were not just telling their stories. They were presenting them theatrically using their bodies
right.
in ways that you just said, do it.
Right.
That was the best audience. It was the most wonderful audience. They loved it.
Right.
I remember her, Diane, making her way perfectly to the center of the stage because it was filled with other people.
Right.
And she did, it's a Barbra Streisand song, but it's not. It's I wanna know what life is for.
Right.
I don't want much. I just want more.
Right.
Something little, and I will sing. Ask me something, and I will sing. I want everything.
Right.
Everything, and it was wonderful.
Right. Right.
Wonderful, and that was who is the woman that Chris was working with so long?
Joyce.
Who?
Joyce,
she lifted her finger and flipped him the bird.
Couldn't really, but didn't somebody have to come and help? She was telling the story about being at work and how she was being so maligned at work. And so somebody had to come out and help her because she couldn't actually lift
help her
finger.
Flip the bird. But also people were talking very frankly about the fact that people with disabilities are infantilized. They're not supposed to have a sex life. Well, of course they do.
Right.
And exactly. Of course we do. And so people were talking very frankly, and Joyce was talking about her sex life. Other people were talking about their sex lives, and that was shocking. Yeah. Shocking.
Well, and you think 25 years ago. I mean, so it was something that no one was doing at that time, is putting people on the stage that everybody wanted to look at, but saying, yeah, here I am, and I'm looking at you, looking at me, looking at you.
It was wonderful.
Yeah.
I've never forgotten that particular show because it was encapsulated so much of what I love.
Right.
That's always what I had wanted actual lives to be.
Right.
You know, that's what I was trying to do in these university environments, but you can't because it's kids who can afford to go to college. A lot of people with disabilities can't be there, you know, are they're not interested in theater, are, you know,
right.
they're all of these things. And I remember it was hard. We were really trying to say to people, look back,
right.
You know, stare back.
Well, and that your stories matter, you know, that your life matters, that, mm-hmm. you know, what you have experienced matters. And people need to hear those stories.
Well, you know what? I wrote this memoir, Mean Little Deaf Queer, and they it's not a plug because it's, you know what, but they reissued it. It's a 15th anniversary reissue with a new afterword because I got cochlear implants,
right.
and that changes my story. And I'll talk about that later because it's easy to forget your original story. But I wanted to say there's a chapter called Why I Should Matter. And I'm saying, look, if I don't matter, then why should Roosevelt? Or why should this? Or why should that? Because we're all swept through the thing of time.
Right.
You know, all of these accomplishments go the way of the stream. It's just like and also my father doesn't matter, nor does his father, nor does anybody whose story you read in here, nor does Laura, nor does Meg, nor do you, because all of our stories are in here. We make it matter.
Right.
You know, we're the ones who make things matter.
Right.
I don't know. I get very, Mickey Faust does that too. And, you know, we try to, it's called devised theater. And it's a kind of a catchword now, but it really comes from these sources.
Right.
You know, from lived life, lived expression, what you're thinking, what you're feeling, what you don't even know you're feeling.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So.
So we're talking to Terry Galloway. This is a pre-recorded session, and we will be right back after these announcements. So we're talking with Terry Galloway, who was instrumental in getting the Actual Lives Austin project up and running. We ran that project for 10 years. Many, many performances, many, many stories told. And so we'll pick up right where we left off with Terry. I want to get back to what you said about I don't want to forget because it's easy to forget. So, and you had mentioned that in terms of Rand, that Rand says, that you put him at the end of the book, you know, I don't want to forget. So what are you afraid of forgetting? What is it that you're going to forget? Like you said, you're going to forget what it was like before the implants, what your life was.
Yes.
No. Yeah, I want to understand that a little bit.
Okay. I've thought about this a lot, and I do this show called You're My Sunshine, and I talk about it somewhat in there because when I was first doing this, I was going, ha ha, I'm not deaf anymore. I'm such a different person. I don't have to be that. I don't have to believe these things. Ha ha, I'm free. I'm free. And then I was thinking, oh, what a monster, because if I forget that, I'm forgetting every bit of my compassion, because I don't think I'm a naturally compassionate person. I think I had to be pushed into it. I had to learn how it felt not to be able to, and or learn how it felt when somebody called. When my wife Donna and I were first seeing each other, there was a filmmaker from the UK, and I was having trouble hearing her. She was talking in a bar, and I was having trouble hearing her. And I had to ask her to repeat something, and she turned to Donna and said, "Is she a moron?"
Oh.
Oh.
I hope Donna said no, but you are.
Something like that. But you get these things all along that let people know who they think you are. Yeah. So here's the thing. I don't want to forget what I went through. I don't want to forget what my friends go through. I don't want to forget that it used to be really hard and that I was a different person. I was angry and I was afraid of people. I was really afraid of people. And I could be, again, just not the person I wanted to be. And I forget what made those things. Okay, I don't want to forget that people taunted me. I don't want to forget that people made fun of me. And I have what is essentially, in some ways, an invisible disability. And I don't want to forget what I saw at Lions Camp and how those kids, even in that camp, we were divided into the shallow end of the pool and the deep end of the pool. And the kids in the deep end of the pool, we could swim that pool. And the kids in the shallow end, as Laura remembers, they were the floaters. And it took every bit of energy for them to turn their heads and blow bubbles across the water, as it did any Olympic champion jumping off a diving board into a perfect dive. All that energy. And I don't want to forget it. And it's so easy because you could become so enamored with this sense that you missed. I didn't realize how paranoid it made me not to hear, how afraid, how prickly, how, what a chip I had because I was constantly trying to prove to people that I wasn't a moron. I know what you really think. Those kinds of things. So Rand and I talk about this because he has CP and there's no cure. No cure. So when we talk about this and we talk about what he went through, what he still goes through, what people still, he was out when he moved to Florida to be in Mickey Faust.
Right.
And he gambled and he's a good gambler. And he said, they can't see my tell because I have cerebral palsy and they're afraid to stare at me. So he made a ton load of money. He paid for his house with a down payment from his gambling proceeds, but you can't, couldn't gamble in Florida. So he went to Georgia. He got lost. It's like midnight, it's close to Halloween. He sees this Exxon sign. He drives up there. There's this little Georgia boy in his truck with his, gimmy cap on backwards, something. He gets up and he says, how he can't, excuse me. And the guy turns around and he flattens against his car because he reeks of marijuana. This guy who's the Georgia guy, and he doesn't know what he's seen. He's probably never seen somebody with palsy. And so Rand knows this. He knows the drill. He says, "I know. I look but I'm lost." And there's just a losing proposition. I'm gonna eat your brains. So he does this all of that time. He does it all of the time. Rand is so good at it. So we talked about this. We cried about this. And I will never forget because, and as I say in this book, because all I have to do to remember is I go across the street and I talk with Rand. His is the last word in that book.
So he is your reminder to never forget.
And he's, yes, and I have others. But Rand's my neighbor.
And your friend.
He's my buddy. He's my buddy. We've been buddies for a long time.
Because he was in actual lives.
Yes, he was in
And
action.
he survived going to Washington, where you abused them. I mean,
Oh, they hated me.
the
They
company
loved you and Chris. They hate my I'm
I don't know why they love was with me, but they were like, we're gonna go to Broadway, and I'm like, okay, you want to gonna go to Broadway? All right, we'll go to DC instead. And I have to tell you, I think you knew this. I think, but after we were in DC, and we did a, you know, a really wonderful
It
performance.
really was great.
But it was because you worked them from every time, because I was there with a bunch of other people. We were at the festival, and every time I'd see someone from Actual Lives, I'd say, because I just sort of hung out in the lounge, because I had 32 people I was trying to figure out, you know. And so somebody from Actual Lives would go by, and I'd go, "I haven't seen you. That's because Terry's got us rehearsing. I mean, you hadn't rehearsed dawn till dusk." And but they did a great performance.
They did.
They did a great,
They did a great one.
but when we came back, this Broadway bound troupe of players, I never heard from them for a year. It was a year before somebody picked up the phone and said, "Are we going to do another episode?"
But you know what, Dallas, she was always afraid when she helped us. She was always afraid of pushing anybody because she was so afraid that their disabilities wouldn't allow it, or when they said, "I can't," you know, she'd say, "Okay," and I would just go, "Oh, I didn't get
I think you
the phone.
can. I think
I
you
think
can.
you can," because there were so many people. Remember the young woman who said she could crawl faster and easier than she could use her 10-ton chair? Kate, was
Was
her
that
name?
Kate?
I think it was Kate.
Yeah.
And she could, she got out and she crawled.
Right.
And it was like, it was beautiful.
Right, right.
I've never forgotten
Well, she was the one that her whose sister used to put her in a pail
that.
and drag her up so she could be up in the tree.
Was Laura, but no,
No, that was Kate.
and the what I loved was the young woman with that rheumatoid arthritis who did that dance,
Yeah.
which was a beautiful dance of she, her rheumatoid arthritis gait with her cane, and the other dancers were doing exactly what she did. And then the music changes and they break into these beautiful leaps and bounds, and she's there.
Yeah, and
And they, yes,
she's still
it
moving.
was, I thought
Yeah, it was
that
beautiful.
was a
That was
beautiful piece.
well, that was maybe, I don't, it was that either that was We're Off to the Crypt Parade,
That might have been a scary
or
Lewis
for the
yellow.
scary
I
Louis
think it was
Yellow.
scary. The scary yellow leaf. We think we're funny.
But I remember the scary, but that might have been the Off to the Crypt Parade. I don't
I can't
remember.
remember either. I don't remember this.
Yeah, but that was the height. That was the height, I
It was,
think, of
there were some beautiful artists in
yeah,
there.
we did some
It was just
really
beautiful,
beautiful
beautiful,
work.
beautiful things.
So from the work that you've done with Actual Lives, and then you and Donna moved to Florida, and you noticed a void in the Florida theater and created Mickey Faust.
Well, this was actually before Actual Lives, and actually before I was teaching, and before I had a tour. Actually,
Okay.
I've been touring, but so when we got there, we started Mickey Faust, and actually, my awareness, but not my complete awareness about disability in theater, arose from Faust. This was back in 1987.
Wow. Okay. I did not know that. Okay.
And also my awareness of trans. And trans issues came from that as well. There was a woman. Okay, we were a ragtag little group, but
Aren't you still?
always groups like ours
Yeah.
never.
Never
It's
mainstream.
always ragtag, always ragtag. But there was a woman named Marianne Ward, and she used one of those big 10-ton power chairs, and she loved Faust. But the place we were playing, we didn't know it didn't have a ramp, even though the guy's sister was paralyzed from the waist down and couldn't get in there. So Faust built a ramp, and then she wanted to be. She said, "I used to perform." So we said, "Well, why don't you perform with us?" So she was the first person I'd ever performed with. But I thought this was the exceptional case, right? You know, there's kind of, it's kind of like that. So we built a ramp up to the stage and she performed with us and we loved her. She was absolutely wonderful. And she was a social worker and she taught at FSU and she got the ADA to make him build a ramp to that bar itself. We built the ramp to the stage. She got the law on him. So he built the ramp, a winding ramp to that space. And then we moved into our own space. But I remember.
Yeah, but the ramp is, yeah. You know.
But that was the first, yep. My first real thing. And then I started touring and then I, you know, was going out and doing all of this. And so that was in there. It was in there. It just was. But it's like you think this is the exception in a way, right. Because she was and I was. You know, right. And there are actually some autistic people in the company, people on the spectrum, but we didn't know that. You know, it was just like odd behavior. It was like, okay.
Yeah. Okay. You know.
Yeah. We had trans people in the company and we learned some lessons in that because there were two trans women and we didn't know. Because we knew that there were men transitioning women or men dressing as women. It was iffy. The things were iffy. Then. But what happened was that we put them in the men's dressing room and they were so hurt. Mm. And we're going, oh my God, what have we done?
Right.
You know, we didn't mean to do this. We just didn't know. And so we said, no more dressing rooms like that. Everybody gets dressed however you want. We're right. not going to do this thing.
Right.
You know, so if you're shy and you.
But what was learning back then? I mean, again, it's a.
That was 1987.
Exactly. So it's yeah, a. So,
but we did learn.
Yeah.
You know, we did learn. Yeah. There are a lot of trans youth in right. Faust now. Mickey Faust, we spent a while at the warehouse and then we got this space in a place called Railroad Square. We were there for 28 years.
That's amazing.
The original owner was this wonderful woman named Nan Boynton. I loved her and everyone did. A tornado came along and ripped the top off the space. And then when we were arguing for the city to put some money into this, the new owner, the son of the old woman, rented it out to other people while even as we were arguing on behalf of his art park. It was like after 28 years, it was like, what? You know, so we've been kind of homeless, but we have found a really interesting place. It's called the House of Music Tallahassee. It's an old blues bar. When we first came in there was no ramp to the stage, and we're going, oh, we can't. We just can't. So we built one, and it's perfect. Perfect. It's captioned. Audio description is one of the hardest things for us to do. And because you have to know what you're doing.
Right.
I know you have to, and you have to have the equipment. And we are a very poor theater. And so we have people sitting there doing the captioning.
Right.
You know, but we've been doing that since 1987 or something like that. We've made it accessible. When we didn't have money, right. We made it more accessible than Broadway was being accessible.
Yeah.
You know,
Broadway still is.
We did. And we had lots of people with vision impairment. We would make that, we would, record the scripts, we would big, you know, the 16 print, you know, different kinds of things. So we did that and we're trying to learn more for this new space. So, yeah.
So is Mickey Faust, is he is he related to Mickey Mouse?
Yes. He's the illegitimate brother.
Oh, okay.
Of a certain unctuous rodent in Orlando.
Well, and I have to say, Terry, that going back to your beginnings,
yes,
here in Austin, weren't you Jake?
Jake Ratchet, short detective. I used to do Esther's. I was one of the founding members.
That's
of Esther's, at least not
Jake Ratchet.
Yeah.
Right. So Rat has been in your and didn't you run
Ratchet? Yeah.
Didn't you run for president?
Oh, I ran for governor. I got 36 in Florida. Vote Berman.
Vote Berman.
I got
right.
36 votes.
You were a rat running.
I ran against Jeb Bush. I had a wonderful platform. I agreed with everyone to right, to left. It didn't matter. I just said, yes, of course, I believe these things. No, I love my days at Esther's and I love my days at Shakespeare Wynedale. Right. I adored that. I love my days here with Actual Lives. I loved at the Scottish Rite Theater when we
you did
got
there,
people with disabilities because Scottish Rite had not worked with people with disabilities. And I want to say, remember, David Dauber, I know he died recently.
Yeah.
He was in that production.
Yeah.
And he was wonderful.
Yeah.
But one of the things I remember is Scottish Rite is beautiful theater, and they have these expensive rugs on the floor and all of this stuff. But and they were so helpful and really, really, really wanted this to work. But when the big 10-ton wheelchairs drove over those rugs, you could just see the wheels. Oh, my God. We had to roll up every rug in that place. Okay. And they were great about it.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to learn how to make it work. And it worked.
Yeah.
It was pretty seamless. David was wonderful.
Yeah, David.
And there were a number of other people who were in that band. And again, I have a list of the names. And yeah. But, you know, but they were wonderful. There was a wonderful young woman who she's doing another theater. There were just a lot of people that I really loved. And, you know, a lot of the old Shakespeare Wynedale people, too. Okay, anyway, yeah, this sounds like, Lord, back in the days.
In the day.
I can't possibly understand.
You young things, you don't get it. So, what's next? What are you doing now?
A lot of things. After I got my cochlear, I wrote a musical, and then I wrote another one.
Is that the Lardo Weeping?
Yes, opera. And no, the Lardo Weeping was actually a solo show. I, in addition to doing Mickey Faust, and I've done a couple of solo shows, and I did them in New York. That's why I was in New York in the first place. The first one I did was called Heart of a Dog, and it was a solo show, but it transformed into Out All Night and Lost My Shoes, which was about insanity, queerness, deafness, a lot of different kinds.
And that's where I saw you first. I saw you at the
Capital City.
The Trinity Street.
Yes, I know the Trinity Street Bar. That was a wonderful
place. That was a wonderful space.
I love that place. Yeah. I did Lardo Weeping there. I led Lardo Weeping.
I saw first Out All Night and Lost My Shoes. Yeah. I thought, who is this? Who is this woman?
Really? Well, I love doing those shows.
Yeah. And then Lardo Weeping. But then that opera company took Lardo Weeping.
Lola. All of those guys, they're so wonderful.
Yeah.
I love Lola. And they used the book and the lyrics for it. And they did this wonderful production of Lardo Weeping as an opera. And that was wonderful. And I had also done a thing called that I still work on. That the Rude Mix had, because the Rude Mix had also sponsored me to come in and do a lot of my solo shows. And I tried out, I was a work in progress called In the House of the Moles that later became The Ugly Girl. And I'm still working on it because I didn't know what I wanted to do with it. But then I discovered I wanted, again, to work with people with disabilities. And so that got taken to the UK. And I got to work with some fantastic people in the UK with disabilities. They're fantastic people here. I think all the Rude Mix are amazing. I adore them. And they helped me push it. They really did. And they're wonderful. And so I got to work with that. So I'm still working on that. A bunch of them have become extremely famous now. And I'm just going,
when's money?
No, give me money.
What you've done?
Yes, I want funding for Faust. So that's cool. So that's one thing. And then I co-wrote a musical with somebody in Faust who's now just recently moved to Portland. Her name is Stacey Abbott, and we're good friends. And I love her. She's much younger than I am, and we just adore each other. And we wrote a thing that was based on something I originally did at Esther's Follies, called The Women of Ravensmead. And it's called The Cursed House of Ravensmead. And it's a musical.
Yeah,
and
I know.
I love it. And so we work with Peter Stepinski, who is the guy who also did the music for the opera, who also works with the Rude Mix. He's, I kiss his little feet. I think he's just wonderful. He's just darling. And what we just found out, we won third place in some contest we didn't even know we had entered. She told me, did you know we won? And I said, no, what are you talking about? She said, apparently. So we did. So we're going, what we're going to get from that is something we desperately need, because neither of us know diddly about musicals or play. It's a very comprehensive instructions and working with people who know about musicals are going to work with us. It really is, because we both know that we don't know.
Yeah. You know, but you know enough to know you don't know.
Yeah.
So that's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
And so that's next. And I have other things. I want to write a children's book. I've always wanted to write one because I love cats, but I also I like creatures that are bad. And I've wanted to write this thing called The Pig Weasels. They're half pig and half weasels. They live next door to their chicken family. And their little chicken family, their little eggs mysteriously disappear. There's the smell of fried chicken. It might be too terrible. So I want to write that. And right now we're doing this big thing with Faust, in which we're trying to push it to get a new home and push ourselves even more.
Yeah.
Cool. You know, I want to tell you some of the things that makes me so proud. We do writing workshops all the time. That's what it is. That's where the fish, it's the idea comes from the head. And so we do writing workshops for months and a couple of times a week, forget that. And it just comes from ideas. So you have people who they really want their pieces in Faust, but they're not there. And this last time we've had two people who really struggled. But they listened because people were saying, but we're not understanding this, and it has to be within these parameters because that's what Faust is. It's like it can't be any longer than 4 minutes, 5 at the tops. And it can't just be a story or monologue. You've got to hone it. You got to make it audience friendly. And we got pieces that I never would have believed from these people. And it was wonderful. And one of them, his name is Robert, and he wrote about being a big man, a big, big man. And his mother made him feel so horrible about himself always. She was this terrible and brooding presence in his life. And he wrote this piece. And we said, there's really something here, Robert. We're going to get this done. And we did. And the evening we opened and his piece was on, he came back into our makeshift dressing room and he just burst into tears because he had to say that. And we were a place that where he desperately wanted our audience to hear this. And I love him. And he can be difficult because he had such a hard time. But I love him. And the other one was a woman named Jasmine, and she has I think it might be maybe late onset muscular dystrophy or something. Very beautiful woman. When she first came to Faust, she didn't want to use a power chair, but we have other people in Faust who use power chairs, and they're saying, use a power chair. It's so fun. you can run over people. You know, you can drag them. It's fun. And she was scared of it at first, but she did. And so she became much more acclimatized to that and her own disability. And she wrote this wonderful piece that she heard in conversations with other people about going in to see a doctor, and she's going in on her own speed, and he takes her chair and he pushes it, and then he turns her around and he sees these bruises on her neck. And she said, my husband and I, we like some rough sexual play. And he says, oh no, you don't, you're being abused. And and so you can understand where it evolves and how it evolves, but it's kind of devastating. And look, it's not brilliant, but boy, does it say something.
Right. Exactly. And it's brilliant in its own way.
Yeah, yes.
You know, and it's these kind of stories that people don't think exist. Yeah. They don't think that these kind of realities exist.
They don't.
They can't imagine it when they see someone in a power chair. They can't imagine what that life is. And that's why they say such horrible things like,
you should die.
Yeah.
You'd be so much better off.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, go die, you crud, because you don't have no heart.
So I just want to, when you were talking about, you know, people being afraid of being in power chairs and that you can run over people, it brings to mind Joyce, who we talked about. And we were doing a show at the Doherty. And the Doherty is another place where they put in a ramp for us. So
oh, wonderful.
We seem to, you know, when Actual Live shows up,
they get accessible really quickly.
But I remember we had extension cords. And maybe it wasn't the Doherty. Maybe it was when we did Days of Our Lives. Anyways, we had extension cords and power strips and all kinds of stuff. And Joyce comes down off the ramp and she just rolls right over the power strip. And we're like, Joyce. And she was like, oh, well, yeah, really? You know, it was like, she didn't even care. You know, she said, well, it's in my way. And you weren't moving it, you know. And so crunch, crunch, crunch right over the power. So that was who Joyce was.
That was Joyce. But here's what I remember about the Dodge. The first time we did it, they didn't have a ramp. Because don't you remember we sent Jeff or somebody up there to a couple of them. Maybe it was.
No, we sent, it was Danny.
Danny.
And Terry Stoller. Right,
going up to that and banging into the stage that they couldn't get in.
Yeah. And then they had to go all the way around. Because at that point, the entrance was outside.
And all the way around again.
All the way. So they went out. So we said, well, you were like, we're going to have to wait a minute while they, and we didn't do anything. We just all sat and waited.
I know.
They went all the way around. It was like,
let them know.
Minutes.
Yeah. Well, they can do it. You can wait.
Exactly.
I love those kinds of things.
Yeah.
You know that Rand was on a PBS special. We saw him. And that Washington thing that they were doing about the people who were protesting and getting that, you could see him climbing up those stairs. He was crawling up those stairs.
He must have been a pretty young kid.
He was very young. We saw him.
That was the Capitol crawl.
It was that Crestwell Capitol crawl. He was there.
I
could
see him. Yeah.
You recognize
him. Because we did the audio description for that.
Yeah, and, we did.
And I was looking at it the other day, and I was like, oh, that's Rand.
Yes, isn't that name?
Yeah.
He was arrested 13 times. He told me he's been arrested 13 times for that kind of protest. Yeah.
But he's been healed. He was had a drive-by healing.
Yes. Haven't we all?
All right, dear. Well, I'm gonna wrap this up.
Okay. But I wanted to say the thing about Meg. Let me do that piece. She wrote a piece, Remember Dignity. That's the piece that she said she gave me to me to do it Faust. And I said, Meg, I got to do this but the best line from that was, sometimes all you have left is your dignity. Sometimes you have to redefine what that means.
Right.
She was brilliant.
Yeah, she was. All right, my dear. Well, thank you,
sweetheart. I really appreciate it. I really, thank you. Thank you for asking me.
This is fun.
So that was our interview with the delightful Terry Galloway. The week after Christmas, the disability community lost one of our leaders, one of our inspiration to lead onward. We want to pay tribute to Bob Kafka. And all of the folks at ADAPT, we send out our love to his partner in life, Stephanie Thomas. And on MLK Day, our show will be a tribute to Bob Kafka. So rest in power, Bob. And stay tuned for The Radio Still Screams.